Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. As always, I ask my supporters and friends to donate something to have this broadcast continue. As some of you know, I do this full time. I'm a professional researcher and writer in Russian Orthodox nationalists and classical fields, since the early 90s. There's no way I could function in any other capacity in society. I depend, I do some translations. I certainly work, but I do depend quite a bit on your donations to keep functioning. And also with donations, it also makes me undoxable. In other words, because I do this full time, I'm not dependent on some other source of income, and therefore, it doesn't matter if I'm public or not. I don't care if my enemies publish everything. You know, my address, phone numbers, it's all been online for a long time. And so it provides me with a great degree of independence. So I ask you to support my mission in this work here to the extent that you have learned something from it, and I truly appreciate it. Today I'm going to do something that I've been asked to do. I've been resisting it for some time. And it has to do with this whole argumentation. It's only been around really in the 20th century that the church, Christ and the sacraments derive somehow from some vague pagan tradition, various gods and goddesses. I was in college when I first came across that, and the classics department, of course, didn't take it seriously. It's not taken seriously anywhere. In fact, the primary scholar in the atheist world in the humanities, Bart Ehrman, rejects it entirely. When I went through in the mid-90s, the extraordinary amount of material I went through in the first 300 years of the church, no pagan bothers to make this argument. And all of these debates and discussions have been preserved. In fact, Christianity was condemned for being new. It would have been benefited if they were to take some of these older traditions, would have given it a certain impetus, but they were attacked for just the opposite. The pagans at the time don't mention it. And so it's only been in the 20th century this argument has come up. It's very badly done. The argument is purely amateur because professionals in the field don't accept it. And I have to say it comes from this desire to debunk Christ and Christianity for some reason, usually a personal lifestyle reason. And we don't know people's motivations, but when you see the vehemence and the intellectual dishonesty that goes into this, there's got to be a lifestyle cause behind it. One thing about Christianity that's never in anyone's interest to join, at least not in Orthodoxy. Outside of Orthodoxy, there is no Christianity. So there's really only a handful of us left who maintain the ancient tradition. Now, in college and grad school, I spent a monstrous amount of time in the classical world. Plato and Aristotle, and of course, Plato and Aristotle are necessary to read any of the church fathers. You have to absolutely master their argumentation and Plotinus as well, and their vocabulary before you can even pick up any of these other people, because they, someone like Maximus the Confessor assumes that you've already read these guys and are familiar with the tradition. And no major church father has ever bothered to refute it. This thesis, because it was simply not heard of. But I spent a huge amount of time in graduate school in the classical world. One of my doctoral qualifying exams was on Plato, and the classical world is something very, very important to me. And as a medievalist, of course, the classical world is essential because this is what, you know, the medieval world is based on, imitating and following classical models. When I've read people like Tom Harper, or Richard Helms, Lloyd Graham, and these other people who have written some of these books, making the argument that these other gods and goddesses essentially had a story identical to Christ, I went to the original sources, of which, by the way, there are very few. I read all of these guys, and I was shocked by how rarely they actually cite primary sources. But very early on, I realized that there are very, very few of these. There's a few fragments that are left. The best hope you have is in Egypt, where at least because the tombs are, they're internal and can't be affected by the weather, there's been a tremendous, there's a treasure trove of this stuff. But again, reading this doesn't take very long, and none of this stuff is present there, and it's very rarely cited. I was shocked to see how this stuff is simply made up. The common argument, and you go through pretty much every god or goddess in the pantheon, and they'll say they were born on the 25th of December, they had 12 apostles, they performed miracles, which, you know, if it's a god, it's going to make sense to do that. They were resurrected from the dead. There is some sort of a Eucharistic meal. There are canons, all these things. It's really the typical list that apparently every god and goddess, you know, even Buddha, who was never meant to be a god or seen as that way, has this identical list attributed to them. And going through, at least in the Western classical period, going through the primary sources doesn't take very long. And in some cases, especially in the far north, you don't have anything until the High Middle Ages before you have any text to deal with at all. The only reason that the Nordic gods exist at all is because the church made certain that the sagas were translated and maintained. These were not literate societies in the far north. But in Greece and Rome and Egypt, they were. Now, a prong of this argument is that these understandings were not made public, so they really can't be studied. They were to be found in the mystery cults. Problem is, no one knows what a mystery cult was, because it's a mystery, it is secret. There are zero primary sources as to what goes on here. The whole point of it was that nothing is written down. It is a secret society. There's a few fragments here and there that they exist, that there's a certain kind of fellowship there, and that's where it ends. So the arguments here are simply made up. So in other words, someone has an agenda that they're going to force on what little primary textual documents we have. But in reading this stuff, you have to understand the ancient world. You have to understand the intellectual context. If you don't, then it might as well not have been translated. One of the central reasons that Plato was so important is because he both recapitulates what's come before him and makes sense of what comes after him. That is the vocabulary of metaphysics and ontology of that entire era. It is complete dishonesty. And one of the things that they seem to do, they figure that no one's going to go and read the primary sources. Who has time for that? Or who would even understand that concept? And so if they make these very pithy arguments that all of these the Mediterranean gods and goddesses all were exactly like Christ in every respect, that's very shocking. They was born on the number of gods and goddesses born on December 25th is so massive, according to these people, that it's just, that's the only date these people were ever created. I hate to break it to them that birthdays were not celebrated in that era. Birthdays is a very modern concept, actually a post-Christian concept. one of the biggest problems with this line of argument is that it contains the classical sign, the mark of amateurism, and that is taking modern terminology and reading it back on the ancient documents. And in this case, they do it on purpose. So if a corpse is somehow reanimated, it's therefore a resurrection. If the creation or the birth of a god is very mysterious, and there's actually very, very little even on that, it must be a virgin birth. If water is involved at all, they'll call it a baptism. And this is why Bart Ehrman and the rest of the atheists who know anything, they say, you need to stop talking like this, because it makes us look stupid. There is simply no evidence for any of this. A, if you understand the intellectual context of the era. B, you understand the vocabulary. And C, you bother to read the primary sources, few though they are. None of this is true. And the list is, for every one of these people, Horus and Mithras and Dionysius, all born on the same day, apparently. That they, all had the exact same life and death cycle, and their mother was a virgin and everything else. And it seems that that's the only model for gods and goddesses that ever existed. Now, the primary problem here, as I've already dealt with on this show, that paganism was never meant to be seen as a religious enterprise. It was a civic one. It was a scientific one. And this is something that I've been talking about for a long time, and scholars of Plato in particular have stressed this, that, you know, we've separated, you know, so-called religious elements from the rest of life. But of course, they didn't. So in ancient Israel, for example, there was never any separation between economic or ethnic or racial concerns or religious concerns. The concept of dividing up reality like that was abhorrent. It was completely unnatural. Only the modern university does that. These are all modern creations. One of the worst things that you can do, and every one of these writers does this, is approach these sources with an agenda and approach these sources believing that vocabulary words that you're reading from these people is precisely how we use these words today. And it's been a huge area of concern with me for a long time. Just a few. Off the top of my head, the word virgin in 21st century means a woman or girl who hasn't had sex. That was not the definition in the classical world. It generally meant a woman who was very strong, very brave, a woman who was complete in and of herself, often a priestess. The word prayer, for example, was about speaking to power. It was about having a tendency towards a very powerful force. Even the concept of resurrection, its origin is to make straight. It's to rule with justice. To be just is to have something exist in accordance with its nature. And, of course, law are the means whereby that could be brought about. A king is associated with the race. It's the head of the family. It's a blood-connected office. For something to be holy, it is something that is whole, that is uncut, that is healthy. The term perfect is not something that has no flaws, but something that doesn't need any outside elements to function, something that's autarkic. Something that's true is if it's steadfast, if it's solid. I could go on and on. And that's just a very thumbnail sketch of essential words and phrases that are used, then and in the Middle Ages and even in the early modern period, but are not used in the same way today. If you come across these words and you use a 21st century slang definition and you end up sounding like a fool. You can't just pick up Plato. You can't just pick up the Bible. These books were never meant to be just picked up, you know, I feel like reading something today. That's not how it worked. These works were an abbreviation of a very powerful lifestyle. It was a civilization. That which was written down was just, you know, certain parts, snapshots that need to be preserved. And that's really, you know, what it comes down to. The idea of resurrection, which comes up quite a bit here, it didn't exist in the ancient world. Its origin is really has to do with kingship. It is to make something straight that was once crooked. The idea of a that something can never die, but that can only appear to die and then come back to life, was something absurd. Now, if you know the current literature in the classical world, in classical religion, they largely rejected the idea of the dying and rising God. That does not exist. It used to be just a slogan that everyone knows is true, and it's not. The notion of the dying and rising God is not an archetype of the ancient world. That's been blown away the last 20 years, especially in classical studies, has been completely blown out of the water. We have so little to work with. There's always this tendency, even if you're an honest man, you have so little to work with that it's almost impossible to avoid imposing your own will onto something. It's very frustrating because the primary sources are so poor. And even if they weren't, it wouldn't matter anyway because they're extremely mysterious. They were meant often for an initiated caste, not for just anybody. So even if they were plentiful, and even if they were understandable, it wasn't meant for the average person. So there's layers of separation from reality here. And to dare pretend that you can just, you know, wander in off the street and read some of these people is just the height of pomposity. And it happens all the time. Amateurism is dangerous for that reason. Amateurism, really, the way I've used the term is when someone simply leaves their field and wanders into someone else. It's very dangerous if you can kind of memorize some of the slogans and the phrases of the field. It may sound like to beginners that you have some sort of authority, and people will listen to you, not realizing that, you know, you're poisoning them. But, you know, the classical mark of amateurism is imposing and projecting modern ideas, in this case, Christian ideas, onto ancient practices. Even to use words like religion as if that was a separate area of life for the ancients. A great source to go to just for the, a very difficult source, but one is very, very important is Eric Voegelin. Some of Leo Strauss's stuff. In his criticism of positivism especially, which I used in my dissertation, is extremely important. To understand, and Heidegger actually is not a terrible idea either. This is an attitude. This is an attunement. It's not simply a set of doctrines that you memorize. Classical understanding is something that you have to learn to live. Now, I approached it as a medievalist, you know, been a medievalist my whole life. And so the classical universe is something that's automatic. The medieval understanding always was that Rome was the archetype of justice and legitimacy. And every medieval polity attempted to imitate it in some way or another. But, you know, we still hear these amateurs. We'll talk about the fertility cult of the dying and rising God. And there is no such entity. This is something that's imposed on the primary sources because we consider, you know, rationally that because you plant in the spring, you tend in the summer, and you harvest in the fall, everything then kind of dies, so to speak, and kind of comes back to life in the spring again. That cycle is not to be found in the so-called religious elements of the era. It's something that we impose on it. Now, of course, culturally, you see it everywhere. But this was not an archetype at all for the so-called religious elements of the society. Because even the concept, you know, most of these gods and goddesses don't really have a death story. If they do, there's about 5,000 versions of it, at least according to the secondary literature anyway. The fragments that we have all tell a different story. You don't see that New Testament, for example. You have, 50,000 copies within a very short period of time, all saying the same thing. It makes it almost completely unique in the world. It's something that you simply can't deny. The text that we have, the primary source text, even, Plato and Aristotle, or Herodotus, any of these people, you're talking about usually a millennium between the death of the author and the discovery or the earliest copy that we have of their material. And there's a few examples. Plato, there's 1,200 years between his death and the first copy of a dialogue we found. And there is no, intensive questioning on that like you would have for the New Testament. Thucydides is 1,300 years. Aristophanes, I have a paper coming out on his The Clouds, is 1,200 years. Homer is about 500, which is very, very good for the ancient world. And you don't have many copies of these guys, but Homer is an exception. And you have about 95% accuracy with the, I think it's about a dozen copies, starting in 500 years after his death. That's very, very rare and very impressive. For the New Testament, of course, you have almost 100,000 copies within a generation, certainly within the lifetime of the apostles. Ignatius of Antioch, for example, died in 108. That's well attested to in Rome. No one denies it. There's no way to deny it. He was one of a bishop and martyr. No one has ever attempted to deny it. 108 AD, and he's quoting scriptures. He's quoting the four gospels as the four gospels. And he's quoting them with authority, as if to say that I quote Luke, and therefore you have to listen to it. It was already an authority. And he's writing, just eternally, year 100. Polycarp died, was murdered in 155. The same goes with him. Irenaeus, who is much later, 202 AD, systematic church father in the West, though he wrote in Greek. And of course, he is speaking of the sacraments and the liturgy and the structure of the church and everything else in 200 AD, again, with the understanding that this is how the church has always been. These things are not the invention of men. There was never a time where this liturgical tradition and the law and the bishops and priests didn't exist. The very fact that Ignatius of Antioch wrote at length about his office as bishop and the hierarchy of the church and the liturgy, dying in 108, doesn't seem to impress anybody, but it should. But you have P52, P66, these fragments. I guess P52 is from 96. P66 is from roughly 70 AD. There's no other set of documents in the ancient classical worlds that's even remotely close to that. And just to clarify something, these are all, with occasional exception, in Greek. Jesus of Nazareth was from Galilee, Decapolis. Look at an ancient map of Galilee, and you'll see it's a Greek area. All of the cities surrounding Nazareth are Greek. Greeks were extraordinary, at the very least, a plurality of people in the area. These were mostly Greek areas. It was a mixed area, of course. But the overwhelming majority of the writing is done in Greek. Europe didn't end at the Turkish border like it does today. European culture went farther, far south than that. Wherever the Greeks traveled, that's where European culture traveled. The same thing goes for Rome. Greek and Latin were the lingua franca all over the place, far beyond the modern borders of Europe. But the modern borders of Europe aren't there forever. European civilization went farther south than that. The first New Testament ever existed was in Greek. The canons were done in Greek. The church fathers wrote in Greek. So to claim that this is somehow a Semitic religion, as if that in and of itself is a bad thing, is idiotic. But the worst part of all of this is that I'm pretty sure that this isn't going to sway the people who are dumb enough to believe that they couldn't invent their own stories. They had to go borrow stories from the so-called pagans, whatever a pagan is. I'm still waiting on that pagan creed, by the way. You know, this isn't a religious stuff. There is no doctrine. There is no set of beliefs. It isn't anything. But the Gospels portray a man who you would never invent. You know, the greatest argument for the truth of the Gospels is the simple fact that Christ is designed to push as many people away as possible. He is humiliated. I'm told that the apostles will voluntarily write about what cowards they are as they run from the crucifixion. And my favorite, that the first people to announce Christ's resurrection were women whose testimony was not legally valid in court. The only reason that you would ever write something like this, this man humiliated who doesn't emerge victorious over his enemies like a warrior would, is that it happened. It's stupid to think otherwise. Dionysius is someone who comes up as a model for Christ. He probably would be the last person, given Dionysius' reputation. There's even the argument that because he was able to turn so many things, whatever he touched in one or two of the stories that exist, even those are only fragments, that therefore this is where we have the story of Christ turning water into wine. Because Dionysius was a god of wine, and he was able to kind of concoct it wherever he went, at least according to at least one story. Therefore, that's where it came from. Why they would only take that little speck is a mystery. He was not born on December 25th. There's actually no mention of any kind of a birth date. His mother was impregnated by Zeus. Certainly no virgin in the sense of not having sex. She was, at least in one version of the story, was raped. He was never called a holy child. And they try to claim that he was crucified. And I went to the fragments that remain. There certainly is no crucifixion or anything that could even remotely be called that. He was ripped apart by Titans in a very, very fitting punishment. But even his mother, you know, there's a bunch of different mothers that come and go in the stories, which of course makes the point that the accuracy of the stories is not important, because they're not meant to be considered true. These are deeper concepts here. That's why every time you read a fragment, it's a different thing. The earliest New Testaments all say the exact same thing. The Dead Sea Scrolls show the exact same thing as we have in our Old Testament. Of course, another reason for that is that people just didn't sit down and translate because they wanted to. I actually heard the other day someone say, "Well, if you we can't really trust the Gospels or the Old Testament because, you know, when you tell someone a story, and that person tells the next person, over time it's going to become distorted." And I rolled my eyes and I said, "You know, as if that's how the church would translate the Gospels." Like this casual, you know, "Oh, I feel like doing some translating today. Well, let's do Mark." You idiot. No, these were synodal, institutional events, bringing in usually a small army of scholars to do this. That's why they're all the same thing. That's why they all say the same thing, and that's why the customary stories of the ancient world aren't the same, because it didn't matter. These weren't the detail of the events didn't happen. They were never supposed to be seen that way. Only the ignorant American could actually read something about Dionysius and say, oh, this, you know, these people believe that that happened. Now, the peasants of the ancient world can see the symbolism in a cathedral, can see the symbolism in numbers. But the modern man, because of his sophistication, apparently can't. He's dead to symbolism. All he could see is right in front of his face. If it can't be reduced to a number and put into a computer, it doesn't exist. The Adonis is one that comes up quite a bit. There's almost nothing on him, any primary sources. I don't know how he could be even discussed in this respect. Some of his followers, I believe, at the time, closest we have is that he lives in the air, that somehow that's a resurrection for him. It doesn't say anything about anything that you would consider a resurrection in our sense of the term. Buddha comes up quite a bit. But then Chun Feng Yu from Rutgers University had ripped these assumptions apart. Books out there saying that the Buddha had 12 disciples and he turned water into wine and he walked on water and he rose from the dead and the Gospels are simply taken from there. Again, there's so many ridiculous aspects of this. Why would they bother? And all the way over there? And why would they take all of these things but leave in the cowardice of the apostles? Or the fact that, you know, heaven's almost unachievable, or that your life is going to be nothing but suffering if you join the church. Why would they leave that in? Well, Chun, has reviewed some of the works written by people trying to make that argument, and he says they know nothing about Buddhism, they know nothing about the pagan stories. There is nothing there that could be seen as a model. Now, I need to mention a caveat here. There's always universal things that you're going to find in any authority. Human beings, as human beings, come under natural law. So the archetypes are going to be the same no matter where you go. That could never be used as, you know, a model in the sense of copying. Human nature is human nature. To say that ancient Egyptians had this, you know, veneration of Isis as the mother, and therefore that's where the Mother of God veneration came from, is laughable. Because every civilization idealized the mother. That's completely uninteresting. Those things that are subject to natural law, family, brotherhood, togetherness, an ordered liberty, a monarchy, death and suffering, the afterlife. You're going to find these everywhere because that's part of what a human being is. These things that are governed by natural law, the agricultural cycle and all of this, you're going to find this everywhere under all circumstances. Only our modern world has dispensed with all of this and exists in a chaos, a complete vacuum, a void, of pretty much intellectual non-existence. But the Dionysius story and the Buddha story were particularly humorous. At least with Buddha, you do have quite a bit of written work. Not being an expert in the area, you know, but those who are laugh at this ridiculous story. I think there's one person who makes that argument. It actually became pretty popular on the internet for a while. It doesn't have a shred of truth in it. The Egyptians are considered to be candidates because there is a close, you know, connection between ancient Egypt and Israel. Now, all of this implies that Egyptians saw Isis or Horus or Set in the same way that a Muslim views Allah, and that is not the case. I said this before, but the concept of the term God and religion are so abused. They are the definitions non-existent. They're stretched to cover so many different data points that they're almost useless terms now. That's not how they viewed these beings. These were works of fiction and were meant to be works of fiction. works of fiction in all societies determine the value system, determine the cultural context of the people. It doesn't make them religious. No one believes that Superman actually exists, but he's still venerated because he represents something very important. The Statue of Liberty isn't a real woman, but it's very easy to see how she would be seen as a goddess if there's 1,000 years from now studying this society, or rock stars for that matter. That actually would come much closer to the ancient idea of God than anything you have in the New Testament. The New Testament writers had to say that, no, this isn't that kind of discussion, as I said the last time, in Peter, for example. They actually mentioned the fact that the fables of the past are one thing, but these are things that happened. And because the texts were written within a generation of the events, they have to be true in literate society, heavily influenced by Greece and Rome. It could easily be checked. If you're going to invent something, you got to make it 1,000,000 years ago. But the ancient Egyptian religion being, you know, loathed by the true Israelites would make it a very, very poor candidate to steal from. There's a claim that there's a Eucharist there, that there's a baptism where Isis tries to put the pieces of Horus back together again. You read what, you know, these stories, and there's a lot for the Egyptians, and there's 1,000 different versions of these stories. Set ripped apart Horus, and then his mother put him back together again, except the penis. You know, the phallus was this, powerful principle, and the obelisk, for example. And that was, you know, reserved to make her pregnant and to create this posthumous child. So you could see really from there where the New Testament came from. You have to be an idiot, or you have to simply be dishonest, or you have to just not know. They didn't celebrate birth dates. There's nothing in the New Testament about December 25th. That was something that the church had always believed. There's no reason to deny it. You know, it certainly fits with the Annunciation. And I've actually heard the argument recently, you know, this is why sometimes I just should have gone to the funeral business like my father. That was too cold on December 25th. Why would they, you know, they wouldn't have survived out there in the manger. I said, yeah, if it's Norway, that would be the case, you idiot. You know, you're not going to invent something that happened just a few years ago. You could probably do it today and get away with it because people are idiots, but back then, there simply was no way. Christianity had nothing but enemies. And the novelty of all of this stuff, the doctrine, the very notion of the resurrection and the transfiguration in the Christian sense were attacked as novelties, impossibilities. A Contra Celsum in 248 AD from Origen is one of the most powerful back and forth between a pagan and a Christian. And that's the origin of some of the stories about Dionysius. But it's in 248 AD. None of the mysteries dedicated to him have any primary sources, nor did they ever have any primary sources at the time. We only know that these exist indirectly. So therefore, you could take no conclusions from them. But you could see how someone who's looking for these conclusions will impose them onto it. Then go to an ignorant Christian and say, you see, this is all copycat stuff. The major works here, Harper and Higgins, these other people, none of these people are professional historians. None of these people cite professional historians. They stretch the term Egyptologist to cover pretty much anybody. These aren't written in a scholarly tone, and critical abilities are not to be found, and primary sources are rare. actual Egyptologists read people like Harper, and they say that we have never seen these translations before. And the fact is, he simply made them up. Or, because they didn't write in you know, Latin letters, interpreting the symbols and putting them together in context, which is actually very difficult for us today, allows him to invent whatever he wants. The hieroglyphs, everything is context. These are icons in a certain order. Americans don't think that way. Moderns don't think that way. There's a place for iconic thinking, but it's not linear. So for the myth maker, an American can you know, get some basic interpretation of what these icons mean, and then juxtapose them pretty much however he wants. Usually reflecting a modern bias. And so it isn't so much that they're just invented out of whole cloth, but the interpretation certainly is. The Horus case comes up quite often because very few people are actually going to bother to go to the primary sources. But as I said before, even going to the primary sources guarantees you nothing. Number one, the transliteration on top of the translation is extremely difficult and is certainly not settled. Number two, there is a lot of different stories for the same person and for the same deity and for the same being and for the same event. Number three, we're not certain of the names because our identities change all the time. Number four, even if you can get through all of that and even get to the right interpretation of the icons, the hieroglyphs, they're not using our translated English words in anything remotely close to our modern uses of them. To call what Isis did with the pieces of Horus after he was cut up by Set, because there was water in the Nile, dips him in the Nile, that somehow that's a baptism, he calls it. While using the term, automatically in the reader's mind conjures the idea of a Christian notion. Oh, I see the connection now. If there's any change, if you look at Dionysius, for example, Dionysius had to hide his god status, given how much trouble he got into with the women he was partying with, changing back when he could was a manifestation of the Transfiguration. That's where the Transfiguration came from. These are wild, speculative, unprofessional, childish, and really very immature ways to approach this topic. But this is what people want to believe. If you believe these, you're an idiot. If you believe this, pretending, swaggering like you're some sort of a scholar in the era, and actually use words like baptism and everything else, you're a fool. Unfortunately, this has become pretty mainstream now. But most garbage becomes mainstream in American society. It doesn't exactly, that doesn't mean much. But this comes from the attack on Christ and Christianity, almost identical to the attacks on Christ and Christianity you find in the Talmud. So to find make-believe nationalists talking about this, and talking in those terms, almost taking word for word from the Talmud, and not realizing it, of course, attempting to support this completely invented pagan narrative, but not even sure of the invention. Even that has various versions. It's simply the epitome of ignorance. And the nationalist movement, of course, is fractured beyond belief, largely because of amateurism. Because you don't have enough people who are competent in these areas to make a proper argument. Therefore, any kind of rumor can simply grow to and take on a life of its own. Some of these guys hate Christianity because of what has become in the modern world. Well, so what? So do I. That in no way permits you to argue that this is somehow evil or fake. Even if it wasn't primarily Greek, there's nothing wrong with the ancient Semites. There's simply nothing wrong with that. I don't know why that somehow was an argument. And I'm supposed to be upset by that. And, you know, I mean, I'm dealing with people who actually, they use the word Jew to refer to the Old Testament. As if the Israel of the Old Testament is the same kind of thing as the Jewish accountant lives down the street from me. The term didn't exist at the time. The Old Testament is Jewish, is precisely this amateurism that I'm talking about. What became Jewish came much, much later. When they say the Old Testament, they usually don't know what they mean there. And their attacks on Christ are to be found almost exclusively from the Talmud. Now, the Jewish sect exists today entirely and exclusively to blaspheme Christ, the Logos. Which actually brings me to my next point, is that you'll see terms like Logos, like in Mithra, and because the Logos is used, it is not used relative to him, because it's almost nothing. There's no primary sources on Mithra right now that anyone's ever found. So the iconography is purely speculative. But the term Logos gets thrown around as if that automatically means they're referring to the second person of the Trinity. That's how the Orthodox would use it, of course. But Heraclius used the term. The pre-Socratics used the term. Plato used the term. And people who are trying to make this connection now are really simply not competent. They don't know what logos means in its philosophical sense or its theological sense. But in terms of Mithras, you don't have any primary sources whatsoever. But what little exists free from other people, usually church fathers, writing about that. I actually have a page from Tertullian, .edu that has a list of every single place where Mithra is mentioned in the secondary literature. And of course, you know, the mysteries are mentioned. In Dio Chrysostom, for example, mentions it, but that's a very doubtful passage, and entirely sure if it's spurious. All of them are AD. What little we can figure out about Mithra. There's no explicit connection with the Roman army. I believe that there was one temple bank. If they call it a temple, there's no reason to call it that. It certainly was a bank for storage of valuables in Britain that had a military insignia from Rome. And one of the images of the bull with who they think is Mithras, it was found there. And from that, they put together, this was a popular group that was able to challenge Christianity in the Roman army. And that's pretty much as far as it goes. There's never been made any explicit connection. And the overwhelming majority of the secondary literature, and usually the secondary literature is you know, a couple of sentences long, except for Dio Chrysostom, which is actually much longer, but that could be, I'm not certain. It's a spurious passage. It says absolutely nothing about it. There's a few fragments in the secondary sources about the mysteries, and nothing is known. And that's probably a good thing, because mysteries could not be spoken of. There is a cultic meal, I think, actually Tertullian himself mentions, but that's simply as far as it goes. Mithras was created, I mean, even used the term born. I've heard that he was born of a virgin, like all these guys apparently are. But he emerged from the rock, which is relatively unique, actually, or almost completely unique in the ancient world. Any of these beings, of course, being intellectual concepts, aren't going to have normal births. You know, someone has sex, and 9 months later they go into labor and everything else. That, you know, why would you even bother to mention that? Of course, because these are concepts, they're going to be very mysterious, and there's certainly nothing that we call virgin in the in our sense of the term. The virgin birth can be applied to Isis in the sense that you could say that it's because she had a tremendous strength and what she represented in justice and truth from the female side, a horse from the male side, is like that. But you're not talking about actual people. So we're talking past each other. These aren't parallel concepts. It's not like we're talking about Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy. You know, there's two people, and you know they existed, and there's records on them, and you could compare them. The argument's been made that because of so many similarities, in fact, John F. Kennedy was completely invented, and he came out of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, they were executed in a very similar way. A gunshot was used in the back of the head. They were warned about where they were going. They were shot unawares. It was a time of great ferment. I mean, the similarities are extraordinary. So according to the logic that these people use, it's very easy to see that JFK, Abraham Lincoln, JFK derives from Abraham Lincoln. It's simply a concoction that people invented for some reason. And certain things have been updated, but there's certainly more similarities between Lincoln and Kennedy than between Dionysius and Christ. Actually, I could go on and on and on and on using their own logic to argue that JFK is completely invented and false because it was so similar, so much of his life was similar to Abraham Lincoln's. But again, the amateur thinks in those terms. You can really mock a position that way. There's an Orthodox writer, his Father John Whiteford, a guy who politically I don't like, but every other way he's very very helpful to me. Makes the whole argument that if you're going to pick an apostle that should rule the church, it should be John, not Peter. And he makes an extremely compelling case that John is ahead of the apostles. I mean, after all, he was given charge of Mary, the mother of God, who is always a symbol of the church. But of course, he isn't arguing that. He's simply saying that you can pick and choose these things and build an argument. You know, when you've been doing historical analysis for as long as I have, you develop the ability to, you know, build arguments under any and all circumstances. I could take any historical issue and write an article completely opposing each other and make them both overwhelmingly powerful. And the process is simply this. You have a large amount of data in front of you. You pick and choose the ones that are in your favor, and you stress them. If you don't know that all the other data points exist, then it sounds amazing. So, for example, I could write a book or an article saying that Michael Jordan was an awful basketball player. He was terrible. Probably didn't exist. Very, very similar to others who've come before him. I mean, it's the same sport and everything. But he's a terrible basketball player. And what I could do is I could make a video, for example, and I could show him missing shots. I'll go through all the footage and find him missing shots and fouling and picking his nose on the side of the on the sidelines, get yelled at by the coach. I could run shot after shot of him missing, layups that he fails to do, you know, going out of bounds, all these things. And if I list them all together, if I make a video showing just all of the missed shots that he had, if you don't know anything about basketball, by the end of it, you're going to be saying, oh my God, this guy's a charlatan. The guy is an absolute idiot. We humans do that with ourselves. Depressed people have a tendency, for example, to just pick everything that's negative in their life and blow it up to such proportions that, you know, what's the point of continuing? Rationality becomes rationalization that way. When you hate someone, you will do nothing but find in his biography the things that you hate and list them all to the exclusion of everything else. Now, someone who knows the person is just going to laugh at you. But the audience are people who really don't know. The Michael Jordan example would not work for basketball fans, of course, because they know. It wouldn't work for most Americans. But for a family in rural China, for example, translate all that into Chinese. They're going to say, oh my, who is that guy? He's an absolute moron. Every time they see him, they'll laugh, having no idea that he's a great player. But because you have created this video showing all the missed shots and everything else, one after another, after another, after another, you are absolutely convinced that the guy's a fool. We have that tendency in all of what we do, both when we analyze ourselves as well as historical events. I could take any person, any event, especially from centuries ago, and make a compelling argument that it didn't happen. I could do it for anything. I could do it for anybody. I could make a compelling argument that Alexander II never freed the serfs. I could talk about the ambiguities in the word serfdom. I could talk about the fact that a lot didn't change in terms of the economy. Labor patterns didn't change. I could go on and on like that and conclude by saying it never happened. I could do that, and most people, including people who know, may say, oh my God, maybe it didn't happen. But it's the exact same thing as trying to make Michael Jordan look like a terrible basketball player. Plato talks about this in the Gorgias. This is what rhetoric is. You hire a lawyer to plead your case, or a PR firm or something like that. And what they'll do is collect all the data in your favor, exclude or explain away everything else, and that's their argument. But it's dishonest. You're paying them to ignore everything else. And when they explain away contradictions, they do it in a dismissive kind of a way. They don't want to get too much into it. That's what objections are for. Lawyers claim objection and witness testimony because they're getting too close to the truth. You want to exclude evidence. I mean, this is how they get rid of contradictions in the official story. But a good historian, you know, an experienced historian could make any argument for anything you ask him to, for better or for worse. You see that with modern historians who spout the liberal line. Over time, they've cherry-picked for so long, there's no one telling them otherwise. They truly come to believe this stuff. Now, the Holocaust being a classic example. You know, it certainly didn't happen in the Jewish nationalist sense, in the sense being taught in the schools. It is a nonsensical idea. It tells me that Hitler threw the war, deliberately lost the war, to divert all this fuel for to kill a few more Jews. That's essentially what the argument is. It's laughable. But given the tremendous pressure that's put on academics, no matter how bad the story is, they're going to believe it, and they're going to believe it with some vehemence. The official line amongst Jewish organizations is that you never debate the revisionists on this. Never. Part of the problem is that they don't do very well. David Irving did extremely well in the libel case, contrary to the movie. He actually converted a few people. So you have your typical academic who's never heard our position put competently before. You have a lot of these pagan fools, you know, they even do some of the rituals. It's all made up because there are no primary sources about that. Who've been cherry picking so long. They don't know what orthodoxy is. When they see, you know, the Cossacks, fighting the Jews, fiercely independent, you know, the bikers of the steppe. That's a different matter. Yes, that is Christianity, as were the Maccabees and everything else. Christianity has a tremendous violent tradition so long as it's done for proper reasons against the proper target. And Christianity in the 20th century is a sick joke. Friedrich Nietzsche was absolutely right in what he said about Christianity, but he wasn't talking about Christ and the apostles. He was talking about bourgeois Christianity in Northern Europe. Of course, it wasn't Christianity anymore, and he was aware of that. It became a mindless conformism with absolutely no substance. someone says we need evidence of the resurrection that's not found in the Bible. I said, well, why does it have to not be found in the Bible? You know, there's, you know, Josephus, and there's the Talmud, and there's Ben Mor Serapion, and Thallus, and there's a bunch of others. But the New Testament are many books. It's not one book. So he said, independent of the Bible, well, that's a compendia of testimony in this respect. So even there, you have complete dishonesty. You have with these stories is a set of ridiculous arguments for people who are, you know, looking for answers in a very, very sick world. And Christianity is not giving it to them, because modern Christianity is a sick joke, not even a shadow of its former self. It doesn't even come close to that. When these young guys come across Orthodoxy for the first time, and the royalist tradition, or the Cossacks, and the intellectual tradition, and John Chrysostom, the nationalist elements, the socialist elements, all of this from the prophets and everything else, that will change. But when Billy Graham is your only porthole to Christianity, well, I would hate it too. Because frankly, if Orthodoxy didn't exist, I wouldn't be Christian. So you can hem and haw and scream all you want about this, call me all the names you want, but you can't get around these simple facts. Is that the pagan idea that Christ was made up from all these sources is absurd, not only on a historical level, but even on a literary level. You know, like, you're going to make up this guy in the ancient world, this humiliated guy who, difficult, surrounded by women. It's laughable. The worst person to create. It's stupid on numerous levels. You could only believe it if you are ignorant, desperate, or you simply don't know. I'm here for people who are actually searching for the truth. That excludes many people, because the truth is usually their enemy. But there's a few of you out there who are interested. Contact me. Christianity is not what you think it is. You know, it is, the truth is out there, and it's actually pretty easy to find if you reject the modern world and its assumptions, but that takes a lot of work. Anyway, I've gone over my term. I belabor this argument. This is really it's a stupid thing. I shouldn't even have to talk about it, but I like making fun of these people. If you still believe it, you know that it's because, you know, truth isn't really the issue here. Facts aren't the issue here. Something else is. You're angry about something. That's really the purpose here. I shouldn't even have to deal with this kind of crap. But it also gave me an opportunity to talk about the importance of professionalism rather than amateurism. Find what you're good at, stick with your field and your area, and deepen it. Don't try to be something that you're not. We won't have these kind of problems. All right, thank you. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.